What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. Big news for water in the West.
In U.S. history, the government has declared a water shortage in the Colorado River. Climate change and the ongoing drought are both threatening the river's future, with less snow hitting the mountains each year.
Everywhere you see right here, all of this beach, this used to be underwater less than 20 years ago. It was the bottom of Lake Mead. And that white ribbon you can see on the hills over there behind me, that's the old water line.
You can see right there along those rocks. I mean, those are rocks that we are not supposed to be able to see.
The drought and water shortage are leading to cuts in water supply to parts of the Southwest.
That news last week came after the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation forecasts that the water in Lake Mead will drop to less than 40% of the lake's capacity by the end of the year. Lake Mead is the largest reservoir in the U.S. It's part of the Colorado River, which provides water to 40 million people in 7 different states, plus Mexico. So what does it mean to live with less water, or even without enough water? Parts of the western United States, beyond Lake Mead, have been facing drought over the past 20 years. One community that's been living with this is Many Farms, Arizona, where Roland So lives. Roland So is a grazing official on the Navajo Reservation. Historically, Many Farms has been an agricultural community, but drought is changing that.
We have a lake, a reservoir that's here within the Many Farms community. It completely dried out 2 months ago. It's happened several times. And right now, there's really not enough water to irrigate the 1,200 acres that we have within the Many Farms Valley. We used to have several species of fish, and lately when it dried out, we pretty much don't have anything in our lake anymore. So most of the crops that were farmed within this valley are corn, squash, watermelon, cantaloupes. Mainly those are farmed within the community, which corn is a staple to the Navajo people. They use it for ceremonial purposes and food in general. From what we're seeing, about 20 years ago, the drought has started to set in. So our people have started depending on those supermarkets instead of farming the crops themselves. At this point, the livestock are not in good health. As I go out there and work with some of the cattle owners, they had to really cut back on their livestock, and that impacts the money in their pocket and their livelihood, their kids, their family, how they feed them. The other thing that's happening is our water tables are dropping. The danger there is if we drill deeper, then we're starting to come across arsenic, uranium, and we don't want to deal with that. Our people have already been impacted by that for so many years. So it's just messing with the water, going deeper, it causes more problems. At this time, the drought is inevitable. What we're doing here on Navajo is we're working with some of our leadership and trying to educate our people to adapt to the situation. If this drought continues and the land is impacted and it's being devastated, what kind of land are we going to leave for our younger generation, for our grandkids, for our great-grandkids? So we have to start thinking ahead. We're developing drought contingency plans as a nation and as communities. That's what we're working on. So, you know, here on Navajo, it's quite different from the metropolitan areas. From studies, we hear that an average family uses about 300 gallons of water a day. With the shortages that we have families that sometimes only go on 10 gallons per day in these outlying areas. So that's the impact we have. We've been conserving for so long, but at this point, this drought is just going to make it harder to survive out here.
That was Roland So of Many Farms, Arizona. So how did we get here to a water shortage on the Colorado River? Right now, I'm joined by John Ross, a writer, historian, and author of The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. John Ross, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Kimberly. Glad to be on again.
So take us back to the beginning, how we got here. And I want to go all the way back to the 1800s and the Western expansion that made life out West possible. Sort of paint a picture of how we began.
You know, Kimberly, it's interesting. I like to start with an anecdote. There's a fresh immigrant to the United States, and he goes out to southwestern Kansas, and in the town, frozen to death in a thin linen jacket. And they discover his body, and they reach into his pocket, and they pull out this brochure that says, "Come to the American West. It's the Italy of America." And I like to think of that poor fellow back in the 1880s as real casualty of the climate wars. Because if you look back for the first half of American history, the American West was known as the Great American Desert, right? Just a place that you needed to get through if you were a gold miner and you wanted to get to California as quickly as you could pass through the American West, the Great American Desert, the better. It was not a destination. And then something happened. The narrative changed. It flipped on its head right before the Civil War and after the Civil War, when the whole idea, encouraged by boosters of all sorts, changed the idea for the American West being a desert to being an Eden, where anything was possible. And that's where a lot of the problems we're seeing today began.
So who were these boosters? Who were the folks who were changing this narrative that led to that Western expansion?
All sorts of people. What happened, for instance, you look at the, in 1869, the railroad went through, and it's this instrument of manifest destiny, of America's predestined, glory about crossing the country and using everything to create this, shining example of civilization, a birthright. And to the government gave great swaths of land to the railroads. For instance, the great Northern Pacific Railroad had almost 4 million acres of government grants alongside the railroad. And that's almost the size of, that's larger than Connecticut. So huge, vast areas. And what they wanted to do, of course, was they wanted people to come out. They wanted people to settle. They wanted people to bring towns, build towns and bring industry and do all sorts of things. Then you had the young states like Nevada. You had a Senator William Stewart, and he wanted to bring settlers in, build up his coffers, his tax base and things like that. And you have this notion that, the way we developed the country in the 1862 Homestead Act was basically every American was entitled to 160 acres for free. Could improve the land, right?
Yeah.
And so that worked really well in Wisconsin and Illinois.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. We have a slight connection issue. And
that's all right. I was just going to say that it worked really well in Wisconsin and Illinois. But when you got out west, it was a different kettle of fish. And then there was this guy that I wrote the book about, John Wesley Powell, who was a famous scientist and explorer who'd been over the American West more than anybody else, who said, this whole idea of developing the West, this Eden, we have to be very careful about it because there's not enough water.
So you introduced John Wesley Powell to the situation. The people who were the boosters who were pushing this Western expansion, this idea of building tax bases and certainly political power, were they, in a sense, the climate deniers of the time? and sort of paint that picture as Powell came into the picture.
Right. So in the last unexplored section of the continental United States was this kind of 300 by 400 mile area in the Southwest. So it's the Grand Canyon and it's Zion National Park today, that area of kind of Utah and Arizona. And that is deep canyon land, very, very difficult and to pass through. We didn't even know, before 1869, where the Colorado River, what the course of one of the largest rivers in the United States, where it went. And so John Wesley Powell decided he was going to change that. So he took 10 men with four tiny, most incredible adventure stories in American history and went through the canyons. It was the equivalent of the moon in terms of we know more about the moon today than we knew about the canyon lands back then. And he came out the other end. They lost four men. They lost a boat. They had no food. They could hardly speak. They had been so. It's a very difficult, traverse, and they made it through. But on that trip, this Civil War veteran named John Wesley Powell, he had only had one arm that he had lost. Anyway, they go down, and he is a geologist. And the Colorado River offers this incredible opportunity to study the Earth's kind of pretty colored soft rock. And when you get into the middle of the canyon, the deepest part, the basement rock, it's gone from 250 million years to 2 billion years, right?
Well,
and you up a mile above your head, you can see the Colorado River. Yeah.
John Ross, I'm going to pause you right there. We're discussing the water shortage in the Colorado River and how the impact of climate denial from the past is being felt today. How have you experienced drought this summer? What's changed for you where you live over the past few years? We're on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. John Ross is with us. He's a writer, historian, and author of The Promise of the Grand Canyon. And we are talking about the drought on the Colorado River. And John, before the break, you were taking us through this perilous journey that John Wesley Powell took out during the Great Western Expansion. And he came with a warning. Talk about the way he conceptualized the climate and what was to come and how unusual that was for the time.
Yes, Kimberly. He had taken this incredible journey through the Colorado River and he had seen Earth's history. And he began to think about the American West, not just as a dry place, but as a place where climate affected everything, towns, industry, social, cultural norms, everything. He was really one of the first people to say, it's not just a matter of being dry, but the climate is something that really affects how civilization develops and who we are. And he made an interesting thing, which is he was a guy who was very visually motivated. This is long before TV, of course. But he drew a map, and he drew this line, this famous line on a map of the United States,
And it went from Mexico north, it went through central Texas, through Oklahoma, Kansas, up the Dakotas to Canada. This is the 100th meridian. And he said, America is basically like two different kingdoms. Everything to the east of that line, if you can imagine that line, bisecting the United States, gets 20 inches or more rain a year, which is great for conventional irrigation and growing crops and things like that. Everything generally west of that line gets less than 20 inches. So he began to visualize the United States in terms of its climate. And he started saying that we really needed to pay attention to the development of the American West according to climate. And this was revolutionary. That line he drew is visible from space, right? Mm. So, you know, 100, you know, almost 150 years later, people from space can see that line. It was his extraordinary imagination that drew that before anybody had been up in the air or anything like that could think about that. So he was foremost in really beginning to, you know, attach climate to the idea of developing and the American experience.
And so the warnings that he was giving about the way the West was being developed, did that clash with this very optimistic idea that you talked about earlier, this manifest destiny, the Great West, and all the promise that it held?
Absolutely. You know, the American identity is so rooted in this incredible optimism. I mean, it's wonderful, really. It's just who we are as a nation, and it's how we look at the future. But it is a double-edged sword, and it certainly was in the you know, late 19th century, when we were looking at this land and how to use it effectively. And it was those, that kind of optimism, this manifest destiny, that overrode Powell's concern that there wasn't enough water to irrigate all of the farms and to create all kind of the opportunities for business and development that all of the boosters were talking about. He was very concerned too, you know, that that the limited supply of water would be held by the hands of the few, right, and who would have undue control over how people lived their lives. He wanted local people to make decisions. He was concerned about monopolies. He was, kind of concerned about, the balance of the haves and the have-nots, those sorts of things. And these were kinds of conversations that no one was having, because at that point it was, we need to get people out here and develop it and take the resources. And so the great progress, with a capital P, right, was just steamrolled so much of what Powell had to say. But he looks so prescient now, of course.
And did they listen? Did they listen to him at the time?
You know, he was one of the foremost scientists of the of that time, and he had an incredible. He was the head of. He was a big surveyor. He started the U.S. Geological Survey. He put into place the mapping of the entire United States. I mean, he was a big deal, and he had quite a platform. But ultimately, up against these senators and these boosters and the railroads and business, he didn't have a chance. But I'd like to think that some of what he said resonated somewhere. But, you know, you do, because we didn't kind of listen to what he had to say, you get this terrible thing in the 1930s. He's been dead, you know, then died in 1901. But the overtilling of so many farmers out in the West and the drought created this great black duster, the great, and blew off the topsoil and caused 2.5 million people to be displaced, one of the largest migrations in American history, this terrible tragedy. And it was all right there from what Powell had been talking about. And now flip forward to the drought today, and you're seeing, you're seeing this. He said, he was, he looked at, he didn't call them aquifers, the great lakes of fossilized water underneath the surface of the earth. He didn't you know, he was very concerned that those were finite and that if we pulled too much water from them, that we would, you know, that it would be gone. And we're seeing a little bit of that now.
I'm going to pause you right there to talk about the next part of the story of the Colorado River and bring in John Fleck. He's the director of the University of New Mexico Water Resources Program, and he's the author of Science Be Damned, How Ignoring Inconvenient Science Drained the Colorado River. John, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Kimberly. It's so nice to be with y'all.
Thanks for joining us. So I want you to pick up sort of where we left off with John Ross in the early 1900s and the Colorado River Compact. How did that come about?
One of the really important things that John Wesley Powell did was he was one of the inventors of the idea of government doing big science to inform the decisions that we have to make when we're operating at this sort of continental scale that John Ross has described. And so as we were doing the kind of growth that the boosters wanted, that the nation wanted, and that John Ross has described, we increasingly needed to do really, really large things. You needed ultimately to have some big dams, some big water delivery canals, and you needed science to support that. And so the successors of John Wesley Powell in the U.S. Geological Survey, especially a guy named Eugene Clyde LaRue, were sent out to measure the Colorado River and say, how much water do we have? Because in order to develop the West, we needed to have these sort of broad plans, and they required broad agreements of who was going to get how much water. So representatives of the seven U.S. states in the western United States came together in the 1920s to try to work out a plan. And the plan was sort of codified and written down in a set of rules that we call the Colorado River Compact. And what those rules said is who gets how much water. But what those boosters in the room negotiating that deal did was make the same mistake that the people who ignored Powell in the decades before that made. They just pretended there was going to be more water and there was going to be plenty of water to do all the things that they wanted to do. And so we ended up with this document that we call the Colorado River Compact. It's a little brief, like all five pages. It says, you get this much water, you get that much water. Go forth and build Hoover Dam, the All-American Canal, the Colorado River Aqueduct to Los Angeles, and on the aqueduct that brings water to my community here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We built all these things based on this presumption that there was plenty of water to do that. But in order to do that, they made the same mistake that the people who ignored Powell made. They just pretended there was more water than the scientists from their own government agencies, the U.S. Geological Survey, this wonderful character named Eugene Clyde LaRue, who he's not as famous as John Wesley Powell, but I kind of think he ought to be. And he was saying, wait, no, there's not enough water. You can't do that without running into problems. And yet we have the problems we have today because we ignored Powell's successors.
And why were they ignoring this? I mean, you say that the science was there, that you had people warning against this. But at the time, there was more water than there is today. There was more water than in subsequent decades. Is that the reason why they moved forward?
So the story we've always told is, you know, they negotiated this deal in the 1920s, which we now understand was sort of the wettest two decades from the turn of the century to the 1920s, the wettest two decades in perhaps 500 years or more. And the story we've always told is, well, that's all the data they had, that's all they knew. How could they have known? What rotten luck for all of us in the West today? And, you know, and I think what my colleague Eric Kuhn and I argue in the new book, Science Be Damned, is that, in fact, scientists like LaRue had looked back at those droughts, the same droughts that Powell saw, and said, wait, big droughts happen too. This wet period that you've used to develop your plans is not representative of the climate reality in the West. But it was inconvenient because it's easier to make a deal and it's easier to make big plans and it's easier to be a booster of the growth and the farms and the cities that we want if we just pretend that there's more water it's a problem then for the folks that come along 50 years or 100 years from now, because it took a long time to build all those things that they wanted. Mm-hmm. So they got away with it for a long time. It looked okay.
Yeah. So talk about the compact itself. Were there winners and losers? Were there people who were sacrificing more and others who were getting a bigger benefit?
We understand today that there were winners and losers because of quirks of the deal. I think clearly, and you know what Roland talked about at the top of the show is the most important example of this. The biggest losers were the Native American communities, these indigenous communities that were here from the beginning. And there was just a sort of short nod to, we'll settle our obligations to the Indian communities later, even though we knew we had a legal obligation. And so a community like Roland's doesn't have access to the water that my community, an Anglo settler community, has here in Albuquerque and that we have in Las Vegas and all these places. The water wasn't allocated to them, and because they weren't at the table, they weren't participants, and were left out of that process for essentially much of the century that followed. And then they were left out of the spending, right? Federal government spent bazillions of dollars to bring water to me and to Phoenix and to you know, places like that. So they were left out. And the other thing that's really important, I think, to us today is that the environment was left out. The notion that the river has its own important values and characteristics, fish, trees that line the riverbanks, the intrinsic values, those were left out too. But then the biggest, I think, thing that was left out is the future, the people of the future. By pretending there was more water, we pushed that problem off 100 years ago onto us today. And this would be a problem as a result of that before climate change, and now we've got climate change making things worse.
John Ross, I want to come back to you. So we see what happened after the Colorado River Compact. And just as John Fleck was explaining to us, it made it seem that they weren't heeding history. They weren't heeding the warnings of Powell and others.
Absolutely. You know, what he, John Wesley Powell, you know, so much helped by his trip going down the river and seeing, you know, understanding that the Earth's surface changes and has changed over time. He developed the whole science of geomorphology, for instance, which is just the study of how the land reflects volcanic events and inland seas and all sorts of things like going that. He realized that we live in a dynamic system. It's not something that every day in a human lifetime is long enough to really see, but it's going on so profoundly. So, you know, so when he came and he saw that, and he knew, as John was pointing out, too, that, you know, you might get some, you know, some really, really nice wet time and, you know, and really decent time west of that 100th meridian to grow crops and all like that. But eventually, you're going to get drought cycles. And that's when great ruination, you know, happens. And so he was basically saying, you know, you got to look over the long term and see that there are these cycles of things happening. And that was on top of the fact that he said, of course, that we're dealing with limited water, you know, and he said to a group of irrigation folks who in 1893, they were in Los Angeles, was this huge convention of about irrigation and the new American West. And they were turning towards technology to say, well, the combustion engine is just coming in. We can drill deeper to get more, you know, to go deeper into aquifers, you know, bring up more of this fossilized water. We can do, so they were looking again to technology to answer their problems. And Powell got up and people were stunned. He got up and he said, I tell you, gentlemen, you are piling up a heritage of conflict and litigation over water rights, for there is not sufficient water to supply these lands.
That, and John Fleck,
Kimberly, is 1893, right? 1893.
Right. And John Fleck, I want to take that point back to where we were leaving off after this Colorado River Compact. And one of the other losers was Arizona, right? We're going to talk more about it later, but it had inferior rights and it was not the best planning and how much water they would actually need.
Yeah, Arizona is in a box right now. And this is partly a problem of Arizona's own making. Arizona was recalcitrant. It refused to participate in the early years in this sort of collaborative development of the systems. And so when it finally got its water rights, those water rights are what we call junior, meaning the lowest priority and most likely to be cut off. And then Arizona made these same mistakes. It came to expect more water than Arizona leadership back in the 1960s understood the river could provide. So Arizona is the most vulnerable right now. It's the big, hot, driest place that depends on this, Phoenix and Tucson. And so I think the real challenges now are especially important in Arizona, but we all share this problem. And, you know, part of the problem going forward, and I don't want to get ahead of our discussion here, is figuring out how we collaborate to share the challenges that come.
And that's a great place to pause. We're discussing the water shortage on the Colorado River. Next up, we'll ask, what does the future hold for water in the West? I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. Tomorrow, we're talking about rental assistance. If you're a tenant or a landlord who's applied for rental assistance, how was your experience? Were there questions or requirements that you didn't expect or that you had trouble with? Also, have you received your aid yet? And if you did, was it enough? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about the Colorado River and water shortage. And at the beginning of this hour, we asked, what does living with drought and climate change look like right now?
Earlier this summer was definitely scary.
That's Haley Paul, Policy Director at the National Audubon Society in Arizona.
We were having fires in places that don't usually burn. So, for instance, like the low desert of the Sonoran Desert, last summer we saw saguaro cactuses burn. And it's just not, that's not something you're used to seeing. The desert's used to being dry, but then you add in just really long periods of not adequate rainfall, and it was definitely suffering.
This was the first summer, Haley says, she truly felt the effects of climate change in her life.
Moving my family this summer from Phoenix to Flagstaff was at first a bit of a scare, because right as we were like moving our whole house up the I-17 from Phoenix to Flagstaff, there was this really big fire that was breaking out called the Raphael Fire near Flagstaff. And my husband and I were just like, did we make the wrong decision? Do you roast down in Phoenix or do you burn up in Flagstaff? And it was a very visceral feeling of climate change that I hadn't felt before.
With wildfires and water shortages happening right now, what does the future hold for water in the West? I'm joined by writer and historian John Ross, and also with me is John Fleck, director of the University of New Mexico Water Resources Program. So I want to go back to you, John Fleck, and talk about the future of water in the West. Given what we know now, are there solutions or are there plans in the works of how to address it?
So I have a reputation in this community as the optimist in the room. and People invite me to come talk at conferences because I'm this novelty act, right? This is good. We can do this. We can solve these problems. This summer has been really tough on my optimism, but I remain optimistic. I'm a child of the West. Grew up in Southern California using Colorado River water. Live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, using Colorado River water right now, and I am remaining here. And I am optimistic that that we can do this. That we can retain viable, dynamic, vibrant communities in these places that we know and love. But it's a lot more difficult than I thought 5 years ago when I wrote my first book about this stuff. And the things that make me optimistic is if you look around at the cities of the West, you see enormous water conservation success. So in most of the major cities in the Western United States, water use is going down, even though population is rising, right? We've got the hang of this conservation thing. We may not have done enough of it, but we know how to move down that path really effectively. And if you should look around my neighborhood, there's a lot fewer lawns than, you know, when I moved into this neighborhood 30 years ago. When you look around to the farming communities, and we need to remember that, you know, 70 or 80% of this water we take out of the Colorado River is going to irrigated agriculture. You see farmers being really, really good at figuring out how to succeed at growing crops and food for us with less water. But the squeeze is coming faster as a result of climate change, and the challenges are therefore far greater. So we can do this, but we need to get on it. We need to be moving down this path faster than I think a lot of us realized we needed to be moving.
John Fleck, is this happening that you're talking about efforts and ways cities and farmers have become better at doing more with less water? Is this uniform? Is this happening in some places better than others? Are there still other folks that are lagging behind? When you're talking about catching up faster because of climate change, yeah, are there places that have even farther to go?
Yeah, let me start with the optimistic version of that question, which is, are there places that are doing better? And if you look at a place like Los Angeles, San Diego, Southern California, doing amazingly well, even though things are really bad, they've got a lot of water right now, such that they can actually help some of the rest of us by moving some water around to help the rest of us. You look at a community like my own here in Albuquerque, doing very well. Las Vegas, Nevada, doing very well. Phoenix is doing good, can do better. Tucson is great. There's a lot of communities in Utah that I worry about because they continue to have that sort of old style expectation that we're going to, you know, turn the desert green with irrigation water. And I think the water in the long run is going to be not there. And so the cultural adaptation that they have to do is more difficult. And then if you look at the agricultural sector, the affluent farming, places like the Imperial Valley in Southern California and Yuma, you know, the places where you're getting all your winter lettuce, they have demonstrated enormous adaptive skills. And this is high-end farming. This is lucrative farming. And therefore, the farmers have the resources to engage in the adaptive behaviors. And that's one of the things we see, right? First world wealth gives you a lot more adaptability and resilience to these kind of problems than third world poverty in terms of adapting to climate change. But if you look at communities that are not as affluent, and Roland's community is an example of that, the Navajo Nation, where farming is far less affluent, adaptation is much, much harder and much more difficult. And, you know, these are people, you look at agriculture and water use in homes in the Navajo Nation, they're already being as thrifty as they can be. And it's much more difficult if you don't have the affluence to drill deep wells or the water to drill to, or you don't have the help of the federal government that my community got to bring in outside sources of water. And so that's where the challenge is. And then there's a final challenge, which is part of the way we do this is through collaborative relationships. So LA's got to deal with some farmers in a place called the Palo Verde Valley. The farmer will fallow a field, not plant it this year, and get paid. So there's cash flow into the farming community, and that water is then available to leave in Lake Mead to sort of prop up the declining reservoir levels. And we need more of those kind of collaborative and cooperative agreements.
And so talk a little bit more about that, because you were anticipating my next question about solutions. Is this a matter of different communities, like back when the Colorado River Compact was first carved out, different communities working together, doing that give and take on a more regional, local level? Is this about the need for more federal intervention? For example, do we need the infrastructure bill that emerges from Washington to direct a large amount of money toward this? What are the solutions to deal with this water shortage?
So let me talk about the infrastructure bill first, because it's really important to communities like Roland and many farms in Arizona. There's a bunch of money in the infrastructure bill to help like bring plumbing to people's houses and water to people's houses. Incredibly important in especially in Native American communities. So that's key. And that's a place where money can help. We've already spent most of the federal money we need to spend to build up the infrastructure other than in Indian country in the West. And so there's not a whole lot of advantage to more federal money to build more dams or pipelines. Just don't have the water to put in them. What we need is more of these individual community conservation efforts, but linked through these collaborative agreements. And the problem is, you know, every community would prefer to have more water. Nobody wants to cope with less water, right? We use this, it's valuable to us. So a necessary precondition is for communities, and this is where I'm a little concerned about political leadership, especially in some parts of the basin, in some of the states of the Upper Colorado River Basin, being willing to have the hard conversations with communities to say, look, that water that the Colorado River Compact promised you back in 1922, it just ain't there. Don't continue to expect the river to deliver that water to you because it says on a piece of paper that was signed in 1922 that water is available. That water is not there. And, you know, one of the truisms for me in Western water is when people have less water, they'll use less water. We're really adaptable. We can do that. We've got to recognize that. And that creates the opportunity to do conservation and to make collaborative agreements with our neighbors at all scales, from local government to state government to the federal government. And this is really important role. We've seen the federal government in past agreements that we've needed to take the steps we've already taken. Federal government needs to provide some leadership by essentially demanding that the states do things. And we've seen the federal government in the past do that really effectively. Essentially, the feds come in and say, look, you guys have to come up with an agreement and show us how you're going to use less water, or we're going to impose something on you. And nobody wants the feds to impose something on them. So they move forward. And we've seen that work successfully in the past.
John Ross, I want to come back to you. At the time that John Wesley Powell was making his warnings, was it a similar circumstance in that you had politicians who didn't want to put their foot down and say, look, this, it's not going to be enough water. We need to figure out a different way, the same way that you see the hesitancy among some elected officials to really say, look, the water's not here.
You know, reading, you know, as I have in that time period so much, it's eerie to hear the echoes of in the discussions that we're having today about climate denial or about some of these water issues, because they're the very same voices with some of the very same. So you see these strains of, again, that whole idea of American progress and unlimited resource use. And also you hear these strains of anti-science, back then it was crazy, but there were a whole bunch of theories that began emerging that, so-called scientific theories that people adopted because they wanted so much to believe that, you know, that progress could be unbounded. There was a thing called rain comes with plowing, and the idea that if you plowed the land, the rain would come. People went out and were dynamiting the air to get water, you know, to bring on rain. So people will, you know, it's a value set of people who really want to believe what they want to hear. And so we're still in that today, to a certain extent. So much of this, and what John mentioned too, in terms of kind of education and talking to people, has got to be really key. It's so hard, because even John's optimism, you know, with the big, you know, uncertain factor here today is global warming. You know, we just don't know. We are really making great progress in all of the areas he talked about, but ultimately, is this a Band-Aid or not? You know, is this enough to really you know, to address, you know, the big 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is climate change. We're just not sure.
And John Fleck, talk a little bit about, we mentioned that Arizona has junior water rights. Other states like California have senior water rights. Does this difference play out in what we're seeing today?
It does, although it may not have to. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who recognize that, you know, we're not going to just keep farming everywhere else while we cut off all the water flow into Phoenix and Tucson, and we're going to have to come up with compromises around Arizona's what we call junior or lower priority water status. I think it remains to be seen, because those are going to be difficult negotiations. Those are the negotiations to come. But the other challenge is within Arizona, right? Arizona had long planned and had an effective plan for dealing with this, that over time, agricultural acreage would be reduced, that water would be moved to cities, and that's how they would grow. And Arizona, over the last few years, appears to have had a change of heart and decided it wants to preserve some of that agriculture, especially in the lands between Phoenix and Tucson. And that change of heart complicates things because, you know, this is Arizona saying we value this part of our cultural heritage, this farming, or we value that economic activity. And so Arizona has some challenges internally because there's still a bunch of farmland growing alfalfa. And we could reduce that alfalfa and, you know, Phoenix could grow for a long time based on the water. And when I say Phoenix, I mean sort of the greater urban areas of central Arizona could grow for a long time based on the water from that alfalfa, you know, which is just a forage crop for, you know, for our burgers and pizza cheese. So Arizona, and we all have similar choices, right? Do we want to continue to do this farming? How important are those agricultural communities? How much are we willing to give up? How much are we willing to cooperate and compensate those agricultural communities to keep those rural communities alive in this complicated relationship between rural and urban West?
Yeah, we heard from a listener on Twitter, Roxy, who said, "We have lived in New Mexico for about 30 years, just east of the Sandia Mountains. Never seen it this dry. We are thinning trees and trying to conserve water to avoid the massive fire that consumed Paradise, California." John Ross, I want to turn back to you. Is it just as we had the idea of manifest destiny back in the 19th century, is it a matter of changing the way we think about what life should be like out west, changing this idea that it's endless agriculture and farming communities and really thinking about it as a dry place and the way life has to be out there needs to be different?
Absolutely. I mean, the bright spot, of John Wesley Powell is that we do create people who can have that imagination to think about new ways that that we human beings intersect with our land. And you know, you look at the way ecology has developed, and we see the more subtle interrelationships between plants and animals and human beings and water, and we get a fuller understanding of that. I think as we move forward, and this is what's great about the American spirit too, that as we look forward and we are beginning to embrace this really understanding of the interconnectedness of all of these communities, of our use of resources, and then that's the way through. And
yes.
Powell gave us
I have to stop you there, John Ross. You're a writer and historian and author of Promise of the Grand Canyon. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Kimberly. Thank you for having me.
And John Fleck is director of the University of New Mexico Water Resources Program and author of Science Be Damned. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks so much for having us. This was a lot of fun.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.